Council for our second matter on the calendar today can go ahead and take their seat at the table. I'll ask the clerk just to call the case so that we have that established for our record today.
Next case, A18-1364, David Green Benoit, petitioner, appellant, first state of Minnesota, respondent.
All right, and council, just please take your time getting settled. Don't feel hurried in any way. I want to make just a few preliminary remarks, and they were the same ones I made to council before, so if you heard them, I'll just ask you to bear with me and hear them again. I'm sure you're experienced and you know how things go in our court, but I just want to emphasize a couple of small points. First of all, take your time to get comfortable. Have the materials that you need to make your argument. Bring them up to council, to the podium and the council table. Take your time to adjust that podium so that we can hear the conversation that you'd like to have with us today. And then the last thing, before you start your remarks, if you would identify yourselves clearly for the record, so who you are as well as the client that you represent. And I just want to quickly note, and I believe this is a citation of supplemental authority. We got a copy of the letter that I think was submitted to the court in this case. It looks like the date is March 20th, 2019. So that is yesterday's date. I just wanted you to know that we do have a copy of that. I wanted to verify too, did appellant's counsel get a copy of that? Okay. And then to the extent you want to address the remarks of the point, the case that's raised, you know, feel free to go ahead. But just wanted to verify everyone had noticed that we have it, you have it, all of that. So counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. David Benoit. We are here this morning at Mr. Hersey's request for argument on behalf of the state of Minnesota in a case that presents one issue for this court's consideration, that is, whether the trial prosecutor committed plain error misconduct in closing argument that demands reversal. I believe this issue is straightforward and fairly presented by both briefs, and as such, I have relatively few comments for this court this morning. This strikes me as a case in which error is quite clear, but prejudice is less so. The error can be viewed in two different ways. The same error can be viewed in two different ways. One of those is that Ms. Burns' statement was never admitted as evidence. It's not in the record. The prosecutor then proceeded to essentially read part of that statement to the jury and comment on it. Comments on evidence not in the record is misconduct. The other way to view the error is that the prosecutor impeached Ms. Burns by asking her questions about the statement, again, didn't introduce the statement, and used it as substantive evidence in closing. Either way.
Of what her testimony was, if under the impeachment line of thinking, mm-hmm. Is it your view of what her testimony was when impeached is that she agrees that that's what she said, but that's not what she said?
My understanding is that Ms. Burns acknowledged, yes, I made a statement to the prosecutor. Yes, Madam Prosecutor, you are accurately reading the document you have placed in front of me. However, I disagree with what that statement says.
The source of the information is what
ultimately, that's what they're talking about, is how did she know what she knew?
Didn't acknowledge. On that impeachment effort, she didn't acknowledge that that she had indicated a different source of information at her earlier statement.
Correct. So she consistently...
Very confusing question.
I believe I followed. She consistently stated, no, I didn't learn it from Mr. Benoit. Mm-hmm. I learned it from other people.
So she was consistent before trial, during the investigation, and at trial.
Certainly that's what she told the jury. That's what her testimony was. I've always been consistent. As to the prejudice, Your Honor, the standard on a plain error case is always the same, the general standard, which is reasonable likelihood of significant impact on the verdict. I would note that if this court agrees with our position that there was a plain error, it is the state's burden under prosecutorial misconduct to show essentially there was no prejudice. Now, there are various factor tests mentioned in the briefs by which this court can assess prejudice. I would like to note just a few of those factors that I think most strongly favor Mr. Benoit. First is the manner in which this evidence was adduced at trial. Both when the prosecutor questioned Ms. Burns and in her closing, she used this very strongly. Even though this was a state's witness, she went after her a little bit. Ms. Burns had just given immensely favorable testimony, said, this did not happen, I believe him 100%.
I was surprised the state called her as a witness.
I have no idea why that happened.
Trial strategy, maybe.
Yes, agreed. Presumably they knew ahead of time that she was going to say this, but they called her nonetheless. So both during the testimony, lengthy is a difficult word to use. The trial was several days. It's 500 pages of transcript. Nonetheless, this goes on for several pages with her asking Ms. Burns questions about her prior statement, a lot of questions that, didn't you say X, Y, Z, blah, 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 blah? Yes. Didn't you then say blah, blah, right? So she gets a lot of information to the jury in her questions. It's a bit contentious. And then in closing, again, it's neither brief nor lengthy. It's not something that took up hundreds of pages. However, it's more than one line. Right, often when we raise these arguments, it's one line in closing. That's not the case. It was roughly two paragraphs. She reads a bit of the statement and then comments on it. So the manner of presentation is one factor that favors Mr. Benoit. The second factor is persuasiveness, which is closely related. Again, this is coming from the prosecutor, an officer of the court who the jurors no doubt trusted. She's presenting it to them as if it's evidence they can use that's perfectly fine for them to rely on, which it wasn't. And it's persuasive because of what it does in this trial. A lot of what Mr. Benoit's defense came down to was credibility, was to say, OM says this act happened, I say it didn't, I have people on my side, she has people on her side. The prosecutor's closing argument not only undercut Ms. Burns' credibility by noting for the jury she gave an inconsistent statement, here's what she said, she's now changing her story, it undercut Mr. Benoit's credibility. He testified on his own behalf. He gave his recollection of the facts, and part of what the state did was to say he's changed his story so many times. He gave so many different versions of what happened, he can't be credible. One of those versions only comes from Dolly Burns' statement. So it gives the prosecution ammunition that they sort of used unfairly because it wasn't admissible evidence. The third and final factor I wanted to point out was the closing argument factor itself. So that's one thing this court always looks to when we're talking about an evidentiary error, is did the prosecutor use it in closing? Sometimes it feels a bit like this is a damned if you do, damned if you don't factor. Because if it wasn't present in closing argument, this court will often note that. It wasn't prejudicial because the prosecutor didn't use it. But when we have the prosecutor using it in closing, they then point out some sort of mathematical quantity. Right? It's so small. It's so brief. It was in passing. And even when it's in closing, we can't seem to convince the state that that indicates prejudice. Again, this was not belabored. It's not pages upon pages upon pages, but it's an emphasis. She reads part of that statement, not in evidence, and then she uses it. She uses it to make credibility arguments. That in and of itself is prejudicial.
What about the strength of the prosecution's case?
That does not favor Mr. Benoit. We can debate whether the evidence, sort of what adjective to attach to the strength of the state's evidence. Certainly he raised a defense. He raised a vigorous defense. He cross-examined witnesses. He testified in his own defense that this did not happen. He had Ms. Burns, who said, I agree, that did not happen. Nonetheless, the jury found sufficient evidence to find him guilty. The three factors that most strongly favor Mr. Benoit are the ones I mentioned: the manner of presentation, the persuasiveness, and its sort of presence in closing argument. If this court has no further questions, we would ask the court to reverse Mr. Benoit's conviction based on the prejudicial, plainly erroneous misconduct. Thank you.
And of course, counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to use it.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, Special Assistant Isani County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. I would like to start off by saying that from the state's perspective, Grandma Dolly Burns was not consistent with the statement she gave to the prosecutor. I would assume that the reason the prosecutor called her as a witness was because the prosecutor had met with her, and she had told the prosecutor these various things, and then at trial, her testimony was inconsistent with that. At trial, she said, well, what he said at the beginning of that statement, your summary, and at the end of it, yeah, that was told to me by David, by the appellant. But the stuff in the middle, I just assumed from, and then she named the victim's sister and the sister's boyfriend. So there was an inconsistency there. She was not consistent with what she told the prosecutor, and from the state's perspective, that is why the prosecutor called her in any event, thinking that she would provide that information about the 15 to 20 minute situation, which was inconsistent with what Mr. Benoit had told the initial investigating officer.
If Mr. Benoit was the source of her information.
And yes, and she said in her testimony at trial that as to the middle of that statement, he was not the source. Basically, she was denying that he was a source. But she had told the prosecutor at the time that David Benoit had told her that. So she was inconsistent at trial from what she had told the prosecutor in preparation for trial. And because of that inconsistency then, the prosecutor was proper in impeaching her with that. I will get to that in a moment, but I would like to point out, I agree with the appellant to a certain degree that the standard of review is plain error. But again, I will come back to where the burden of proof falls to show that this did not substantially affect the jury's verdict.
Well, your brief seems to argue that the manner in which the state presented Grandma Dolly's prior statement comported with the rules of evidence. Is that your argument?
That is one of my arguments. My primary argument today is that under Stofflet and Matthews, both of which I cited in my brief, this is harmless error. And we need not necessarily get to this other issue because you need not get to the other prongs of plain error if, in fact, it did not affect the verdict. But I would like to just cover the reason for that. First of all, the prosecutor had the right to impeach Burns. She gave an inconsistent statement from what she told a prosecutor in preparation for this trial.
There are ways to impeach and ways that that impeachment can be used. And are you saying the prosecutor comported with the rules in those regards?
What I would focus on would be this was intrinsic impeachment. This came out of the witness's own mouth. This came out of the mouth of Burns. If, in fact, the prosecutor had attempted to introduce that statement or had called another witness to impeach Burns with what she had told the prosecutor in that meeting, then that would have been extrinsic impeachment. This was intrinsic impeachment. And under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 16B, there is no need for extrinsic impeachment by introducing a document or testimony of another witness if that witness admits that they had made the prior statement and essentially what that prior statement was.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's get to how it was used in closing argument.
Moving on to that particular point, I would submit that, first of all, the impeachment was proper under 613B because it was intrinsic impeachment. Now, a prior inconsistent statement normally could not be used substantively because it would be hearsay under Rule 8. But as my citation indicated to the Jefferson case, which in turn cites Ortlieb, if, in fact, the statement fits within the residual hearsay exception under Rule 807, then it can be used substantively. And that is what Jefferson says. Jefferson cites to Ortlieb, and Ortlieb, in turn, has quite a body of law built around it that says that if there are circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness, such as the other exceptions to the hearsay rule, then that is an exception to the hearsay rule. It fits there, and it can be used substantively. And the things that they pointed out in determining whether it could be used substantively in Jefferson and Ortlieb is, one, was the declarant, which was Burns in this case, available for cross-examination, which she was. Did she acknowledge that prior statement? She did. She said, you know, that's what the document says. You know, you summarized our meeting, and that's what the document says. And she said that a couple of different times.
Didn't she say, but I didn't say what's in the middle?
Yes, yes. She said, Well, she did say she said it. She did say she said it. She said, but David was not the source of it. I got it from the victim's sister and the victim's sister's boyfriend. So she's...
floppy kinds of statements all that trustworthy, such that it would fall under the residual hearsay rule to be used as substantive evidence.
I would ask the court to take a look at Ortlip and the related cases. There are at least two, in addition to Jefferson, which is an unpublished court of appeals decision. There is the case of State versus Martinez, Supreme Court, 725 Northwest 2nd, 733 from 2007. There is also the Supreme Court decision of Oliver, which was 502 Northwest 2nd, 775, a Supreme Court decision from 93. And then, of course, the Ortlip decision, which is cited in the Jefferson case. And those cases do, at least according to the Supreme Court, if you go through and analyze the factors, show that those do have guarantees of trustworthiness. The declarant in this case, another factor was that the declarant was hostile to the state and hostile to the victim, clearly aligned with the appellant. And there was strong other evidence that showed the defendant's guilt. The victim's statement, the victim's consistent statements, the surrounding facts, the corroboration, the fact that she left in the middle of the night in a place where she didn't know where she was, went to the first house that was lit up, reported that to strangers, was consistent in all her reports to the police officers, to her mother, to her sister, and the fact that the appellant's version was simply incredible. He basically said that she just disappeared in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere where she didn't know where she was, and he had no reason to know. And when asked, well, why would she report you as committing criminal sexual conduct, his comment was, well, she comes from a dramatic family. So I would submit that when you look at the fact that Burns was available for cross-examination, she acknowledged the statement and what she had told the prosecutor, the fact that she was hostile to the state, and that other evidence, and this other evidence strongly showed the defendant's guilt, that does fit within the residual exception under the Supreme Court's prior decisions, which has been followed in a number of decisions of this court, mostly unpublished, but I believe there may have been one published one in there, Sukup. So I would be asking the court to do that. But I would like to focus some time on both Stofflet and Matthews and the factors in there to show that this error was harmless. In Stofflet, the error of the prosecutor was impeaching the witness with a prior inconsistent statement intrinsically through the witness's mouth, except that the witness denied two of the statements. And the prosecutor, apparently assuming that the witness had admitted all of those statements, used that substantively in closing. And I think that's an important thing to focus on. But the court in Stofflet said that was harmless error. It wasn't a case where the prosecutor's statement had no basis in fact, and had the prosecutor recalled a witness to put in the other part of the inconsistent statement that the witness had denied, it would have been proper. And additionally, the court felt that the jury probably would have still discredited the witness because the state's evidence was strong and the victim's testimony was corroborated. As to the Matthews factors, I respectfully disagree with counsel's analysis of those factors. As to the manner of presentation, I would submit that the impeachment of Burns was appropriate because she did make an inconsistent statement. I would submit as to whether or not it was highly persuasive. I would say that it is not in light of all the other evidence. From the state's viewpoint, this is a strong case evidentiarily. And in light of that, this was not highly persuasive. And in fact, the jury may well have disregarded Burns' testimony altogether because Burns was so hostile to the victim. She said at one point in her testimony, no ifs, ands, or buts, appellant did not do this, and basically concluded her testimony by saying, well, I don't believe half the crap she says anyway. So she was clearly hostile to the victim. And she had an interest because she was living with the appellant. The appellant provided some financial assistance to her, and as she was aging, he provided some physical assistance as well. But I would submit, again, the victim was consistent in her several reports, and her actions were consistent with someone who had undergone a sexual assault. She fled the campsite, as one would expect. It was in the middle of the night. She didn't know where she was. She had no shoes. She was just dressed in shorts and a halter top. She went to the first house that was lighted up and reported to complete strangers that she had been sexually assaulted by a person she termed as basically her uncle. And the people noted that her bra was unhooked. She was trying to hook her bra, and she was very upset, very frightened. And again, the appellant's version strained credulity, that he simply, that the victim just walked off in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, where she didn't know where she was, and he did not use his cell phone to alert the victim's mother, the victim's sister, or for that matter, even Ms. Burns, the surrogate grandmother, for an hour and a half to 2 hours. And when the deputy found him, he was simply walking down the road with his flashlight. And when he was informed that he was accused of sexual assault, his response to the deputy was, "Really?" And I would submit that the use in closing argument, and I would ask the court to take a look at that, was quite brief. It was just a few lines in a 25-page closing argument. And another factor under Matthews is whether the defense was able to counter the evidence. And I would submit that they certainly were. The defense counsel was very strong in establishing that Burns did not believe the victim. He used Burns to establish a motive for the victim to fabricate, and that had to do with the victim being mad at the appellant because he wouldn't take her to the Mall of America, and Burns claimed that the victim had said, "Well, I'll get even with you." And additionally, the defendant himself testified and denied it. I would submit that there's no reasonable likelihood that the absence of the alleged error would have any significant effect on a jury trial. And unless there are some further questions for me, I will conclude.
I'm just puzzled about the reference to Jefferson and Orlip a little bit, in that the way I read the transcript, the aunt did not agree that she had made a statement out of court that she had obtained the information from the appellant himself. Am I reading the transcript correctly?
Judge, I read it just the opposite. I think she's kind of the surrogate grandmother. You're referring to Burns.
Yes, I am, Burns.
Okay.
I'm trying not to use names.
I would ask the court to focus on pages 283 and 284 and 285 of that transcript. And I read it to say that she's saying, "Well, he told me the beginning, he told me the end, but he's not the one who said the stuff in the middle. Yes, I told you that, but that I just assumed that. But I told you that David Benault, had said that." That's how I read that. And perhaps I'm reading it wrong, but I would ask the court to focus on that.
If she acknowledged the out-of-court statement that David told her that, then I think it makes sense to me how you might say that could be substantively admissible.
And I would note that the prosecutor asked specifically on page 285, okay, and that David then told you that he tucked her in and that about 15 to 20 minutes later, Olivia comes running out of the tent saying she had to go to the bathroom. Is that right? Uh-huh, that's right. That David told you that he told Olivia that she should take a lantern and a light source of some kind and Olivia left and never came back. Is that right? That's what it says. So from my perspective, she is acknowledging
acknowledging that that's what it says.
That's what
she's
the notes of her statement.
That's what I said.
The notes, but that's the summary of her statement to the prosecutor.
Okay.
And the prosecutor, at the beginning of this, laid some foundation for the fact that this was, in fact, a summary and had her read through it. And she said, "Yes, that refreshes my recollection." So that is how I read that particular part of the transcript.
Okay, I can look at the transcript. Thank you.
Thank you.
And appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I submitted to this court at the beginning of my argument that this issue was straightforward. Mm-hmm. I believe over the course of the morning it's become confused, so I'm going to attempt to get back to clarity because I do believe the issue is very clear. Your Honor, Judge Rodenberg, I think I can perhaps shortcut your question about 807. To be honest, I only had a few minutes to look at Jefferson this morning, but I was surprised that it was cited because I think it has nothing to do with this case.
Because it wasn't substantively admitted as
It was not admitted at all. It certainly wasn't admitted as hearsay. Jefferson and the cases it cites are about whether or not something was properly admitted as hearsay. We have no evidence admitted about Burns's statement here at all. It's not in the record.
No,
it's not in evidence.
No one testified that Burns made the statement about the source of the information.
No, she's impeached about it. And I believe Your Honor is absolutely correct. She says, I read your summary, Madam Prosecutor. You just accurately stated what it says. She never says, I told you before I heard it from David. So those cases have nothing to do with this case. There's no admission of hearsay evidence. So this court doesn't need to question whether the hearsay evidence can be referenced in closing. It can't. It's not in the record. The other points about inconsistent statements by the grandmother and by whether or not she can be impeached are not the way we raise this issue. The question is whether the prosecutor can talk about it in closing. That's it. That is the error that was clear. As to sort of the eventual opinion that will come out of this court, I would ask you to address the error. Even if we lose on prejudice, I think it's very helpful to practitioners to have opinions about whether or not there was an error. I actually, myself, have another case pending right now with this same error. So it's happening in district courts. It's coming up. And I think guidance from this court would be very helpful no matter what you conclude. The only other point I would make is that the factor for prejudice about whether or not the evidence was effectively countered, the way I understand that factor is it's about whether the defense attorney countered the particular evidence challenged. Not about whether the defense put on a case or whether the defense attorney did anything good at trial. He did. He questioned witnesses. He put on evidence. That's not what we're asking. We're asking whether he countered this evidence. I'm not sure how he could counter something the prosecutor did in closing argument in which she said, I'm going to read you a statement and make conclusions about it. So I would disagree that that factor favors the state. Otherwise, I would ask this court to reverse Mr. Benault's conviction based on the plainly erroneous misconduct in closing and because it was prejudicial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame, and my thanks to counsel. Well briefed, well argued.